Welcome to another Men of 8 Gang podcast, episode 154. I'm Steve Borsch, and I'm on with Tim Elliott.
Good Sunday morning.
Graham Thickens.
Hey, I like that guitar music, man.
Yeah, I did that last night. Phil Wilson. Are you there, Phil?
I'm here. Of course I'm here.
Oh, good.
Where would
excellent.
I be?
I don't know. So how you guys doing?
Great, thank you.
Good.
Well, yeah, good day out there.
It's nice and sunny.
Another nice warm winter day in Minnesota.
Yeah,
nice
once again.
Lakeville's going to be represented again today. I'm pretty excited about that.
That who's going to be represented?
Lakeville's going to be represented today in the old Men of 8 Gang podcast.
So. That's right. That's right. Yeah, well, we'll talk about our guest here in just a little bit. But, you know, Phil, since you were the moderator, why don't you give a quick overview of what happened at SMB MSP, the social media breakfast, yesterday?
Well, you know, it'd probably be better for you two because you were in the audience. I was the moderator. I had a single viewpoint of, not trying to pit out my shirt. But other than that,
okay.
It was good. We had a great panel of public media folks from NPR, from MinnPost, and from TPT. It was a large panel. I always get concerned about the large panels because you have got so many people that you want to involve. But they all very well behaved, as you might expect from public radio and public TV. People.
That's right. Well, I will say as an audience member that I was amazed that it went as well as it did with so many people. It flowed very well. I think people were really, really interested in what everybody had to say. Fun venue to be at TPT. Even though I walked next door afterwards to see how the sausage was made with the almanac set. Yeah. And oh my God, the thing is it's about as big as my living room. I thought it was this enormous set because they show the set from a camera way up in the corner. And that was kind of amusing, but they're doing a lot in social media at TPT specifically.
Yeah, we enjoyed a good discussion. We talked a lot about, we avoided the whole, agenda, is public media a liberal agenda, that sort of thing, because I didn't really think that was necessarily pertinent to the conversation about social media. Whatever your message is, social media is the pipeline. We're just talking about the tools, and had a great time listening to John Moe, David Brower and John Moe, obviously our comic relief great insight from both of them. And then Mary LaHammer was there. Jonathan Keeling from Public Radio International, Julia Schrinkler from NPR, and of course our host, John Danzer from TPT. So
yeah,
it was a great time. I believe it is posted on the web at smbmsp.com.
Oh, it so is.
Take a look at it. I believe it will be. So if it's not there now, it will, because it was live streamed. Kudos to Michael Roventine and the gang at SMB for putting together yet another one.
Yeah, no kidding.
So Phil, there were a lot of public media folks there. Were there a lot of private media folks there too, or?
I think all of us are private media folks now.
Traditional newspaper folks.
This was strictly, focused on, of course the caveat was using social media to, work with a business that's not tied to the bottom line and more tied to a mission statement. Well, that's not necessarily true. Everything's tied to a bottom line in some way, shape, or form. But this was basically talking about, using it to drive mission. And well, I think the takeaway was that, yes, they believe they need to be very involved. They have better success with people on social media, not brands on social media. And most public entities are using this as a separate channel, not necessarily designed to drive viewership or readership or listenership. So those were sort of the big takeaways. Am I right, Steve?
You are right. Yeah. And it's, it was interesting because a couple people just touched on this, but about Twitter is almost in some ways acting as a channel of announcement for public media, but the people, the reporters and journalists and people that are involved in the technology itself, like a John Danzer, are actually using it to connect with people. And it was all about the power of connection. So there was just a little bit of touching on it as a channel and a lot of discussion around social media overall about just engagement and connecting with one another.
And the word enrichment was used quite a bit yesterday too. So as you might expect at a public event,
meaning pocketbooks.
Right.
What did John Moe call it? Because Julie Schrinkler read the mission statement for NPR, and John Moe said that's now available on a tote bag. So
exactly.
But it was interesting. I was kind of surprised that people found that Facebook was so successful as far as engaging people. And
I know
some avoided it, and some realized its power. I still believe if you want to talk to real people that Facebook is the place to be. If you want to talk to more reporters and celebrities and geeks like ourselves, that's the place to be. But I think that real people still hang out on Facebook.
Yeah.
And I believe David Brower is doing himself a disservice by avoiding it.
Well, and then also there was hardly any discussion about Google Plus, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, and Ron McCoy inspired my comment of, you know, the number one rule, you know, first rule of Google Plus is nobody talks about Google Plus.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right.
So was Pinterest brought up?
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
Well, that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah. They must have some big PR push going on right now at Pinterest. Was that what's going on?
You know what we read today in the Variety section, front page feature in the Tribune on Pinterest? That sucker started in Des Moines, or the founders from Iowa.
Right.
And it first caught fire in Des Moines, even though the company's in Palo Alto. And it's like, that's interesting to me. It's like, why did it just catch fire in Des Moines first? Because the founder was promoting it there or whatever, but it's strongest in the Midwest.
In the Midwest, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
And there are other cities, including here, where it caught fire.
Well, I got to tell you, I have connected with so many people in my knitting circles that through Pinterest. No, yeah. I'm teasing everyone. That was a good article. In the Strib this morning.
Yeah.
I'll put it in the show notes. But Tim, WordPress MSP happened too. What happened during the event?
There were about, I don't know, 20 people there. Various folks, some people I didn't know, some people I knew. And we talked about some of the workflow tools. John, on his Linux machine, showed Aptina. Studio 3, which is it's basically a coding environment, and showed how he uses it to do WordPress plugins and such. And then Tom Penny showed Coda on the Mac. So they sort of had a head-to-head. And then I got up and talked about the third run of Full Court WordPress. It's coming up at the Overnight Website Challenge.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. Late in March. So... We're recruiting folks for that at the moment.
I thought there was always more people that wanted to be involved than there was space.
Well, that happened last year, but it hasn't happened yet this year. And we said that if we do get something like that, we'll field two teams.
Oh, good idea.
Yeah. So I'm still looking to fill out the first team. So I'm, you know, trying to get the band back together. But if there's some new folks. That are interested, we'll consider and bring them on too.
Great.
So I've got a game plan this year on how to do better than we did last year. So
excellent. Well, I don't know. Also, if you go ahead, Graham, you're gonna.
I was gonna say I've got a WordPress question. What's this meetup event that Hacks and Hackers is doing? How to create your own WordPress theme? Have you guys heard about that?
No, I hadn't seen that.
That's Toby Krenz and somebody else that are doing that.
Right. That's coming up on next Friday?
Friday, February 3rd, and it's sponsored by PRI and SJMC, Minnesota Journalism Center.
Huh, is that no, the I didn't workshop? Know. I know they're doing a workshop that's, I think, about $100 that's, you know, how to translate your design into a WordPress theme. So that may be the same thing, but it is next Friday.
Yeah, and it appears to be $125.
Oh, okay.
Which I don't get. It's like, well, are they inviting in some big time national speaker or something, or what is this?
Well, no, they probably are
probably looking to make money at.
Them, and they're trying to offset their time because it's going to be a 4 to 6 hour kind of a deal.
Exactly. Okay.
Yeah. It's worth money, I suppose, isn't it? I mean, have you guys tried to
create
your own WordPress theme?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's actually extraordinarily simple, right, Tim?
I was the complete opposite.
It is the complete opposite.
On how complicated it is. So
yeah.
If it's simple, it's not that hard to do. But
a lot of CSS, is that you got to be a CSS master?
Well, the CSS is the easy part. The PHP is that can be kind of complicated. Depends on what your design looks like. But so if it's pretty simple, you can just take one of the preloaded themes, like 2011 is the default theme now. You can take all the PHP out of that and just add your HTML and CSS to it and create a custom theme if it's fairly simple.
Or you can use it as a parent
track of the acronyms theme. That is now 15 acronyms.
And there's no extra charge this morning for
that's what we did last year. Overnight website challenges. We took 2010, the default WordPress theme, and radically changed it. So if you go to the Project 515 website, that's actually 2010. It started as 2010, and then we, designed it from there, and it looks nothing like that. So that's basically just taking your design and taking an existing theme and adapting the PHP hooks to it.
Yeah. So, yeah.
But I think Toby is going to get into, it in a little bit more detail. So it's going to be several hours, and it's a.
Oh, Toby's conducting this.
Yeah, and this other woman whose name escapes me, who is another designer, they're doing it together. So it's meant to be sort of an intensive thing. I think they're going to be maybe holding it to 15 or 20 people total, so they can have a lot of hands-on one-on-one.
Sure, makes sense.
And it's really meant for designers who understand how to do Dreamweaver sites, and they want to get into WordPress. So it's to take your design and your HTML and to actually cut it into a WordPress theme. So.
Yeah. Well, let's because we're going to have someone on who is responsible for an entire school district. We've got to just touch on what's going on with tablets and the whole textbook thing and so on. And somebody put in the show notes here about the Pew Internet. Who did that?
I did. And what I found it was interesting is if you look at the chart, tablets really didn't. I mean, they sort of took off from a mindshare perspective last year, and maybe even the year before. But e-readers really, until recently, were selling more than tablets. And over the holidays, it's caught up, and both of them are neck and neck as far as adoption. And it's way over, almost double over what they were in just December as far as penetration. So. Interesting stuff. I guess maybe last year was the year of the tablet.
Wow. Well, I mean, it's definitely taking off with what's going on with textbooks. You know, Apple's whole initiative with iBooks Author and EPUB 3, which we really haven't heard a lot about. There aren't a lot of generic tools out yet that take advantage of EPUB 3, but EPUB 3 is going to add a lot of the features that that Apple has shown that are quote unquote unique to iBooks Author, adding animations and flowing text and things of that nature. Have you guys watched what's been going on? Well, first off, have you actually downloaded iTunes U?
No. I don't have Lion yet, so I can't get it. And this is really the first time that I've have to upgrade. I've resisted upgrading until now, and now I will have to do it just to get iBooks Author, because I think it's that important.
It is. I remember for those that are listening, if you haven't used iWeb, for example, on the Mac platform, Apple's no longer supporting it. But when iWeb came out, because it was drag and drop, and it was the closest thing that I've ever used to desktop publishing for the web, where you had a lot of control over the look and feel of a page and where elements were and so on and so forth. And Dreamweaver certainly isn't that. I mean, you've got a lot more control, but it's always been frustrating that there haven't been higher level tools that are really easy to use that produce really powerful stuff. And when I downloaded iBooks Author and looked at that, and then looked at what you can do with Xcode, which are the developer tools, and you can add functionality to the book, my jaw just dropped.
Yeah, I think that's why that there's so much controversy and why people are, you know, are claiming that Apple is, you know, not adopting the standard because they want to take control of the market. It's because they want to use the tool for creating books that are sold elsewhere outside of the Apple ecosystem. And there's, there's really no reason why Apple should support it. So if the market works, then somebody else is going to come up, probably Amazon is going to come up with, either a totally open solution that supports standards or their own proprietary EPUB based solution that will, give people the same sort of power to author for, say, the Kindle Fire or other tablets to compete with the iPad.
Well, and it could very well be Adobe, who has taken a real leadership position in digital publishing, except it's as though you need a new lock for your front door and they are trying to sell you an Abrams tank and a bunch of bazookas.
Yeah, I think Adobe's got a real problem, and it reminds me of Kodak in a way that, you know, they've got this existing business model, and for them to really be relevant and to get to the next level and to really mature as a company, they're going to have to blow up their existing business model, and I don't think they're going to do that. They've got PDF, and they think that they can, you know, extend PDF, and they really can't. They have to, I think, get behind EPUB and do some other stuff and really create the best tools for the higher end user. That's their business, is creating these tools. It's not to create these standards that that everyone has to license, like what they did with PDF and like they did with Flash. So, but I don't think that they're going to do that. I think they're going to do the Kodak thing and they're just going to languish for a while. They'll still make good money selling Photoshop and other parts of the Creative Suite, but for the most part, their core business will pass them by before they do anything about it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I will tell you that there's a lot of pent-up demand to be able to publish anything to the iPad. And not only with the textbook thing for K-12 education and what's happening in higher ed with that, but also, just with app development tools, it's exploding. But Phil, with your kids, Do you and your wife ever sit back and watch them walk out the door with these backpacks that weigh about 75 pounds each?
Well, yeah. I mean, we kind of look at it also for Kate. It helps her posture. But anyway, yeah. it is incredible the amount of weight these kids are carrying around these days. So it's amazing to see.
Does this excite you at all?
Yeah, of course it excites me. It intrigues me as well. I mean, as we'll talk with our guest coming up here, why don't you go ahead and call her, give her a dial in. That's Lisa Snyder.
I will.
Who is, I've had an opportunity to speak with before and had been involved with our school board here in Lakeville. Lisa Snyder is the superintendent of schools here.
New superintendent of schools.
Fairly new, yeah. And she's jumping right in and taking on tech and integrating both mobile and interactive technology into the school system. And there's a big push underway. And I'll let her tell us a little bit about that.
Good morning, Dr. Snyder.
Good morning.
This is Steve Borsch, and you've got Graham Thickens, Tim Elliott, and Phil Wilson on.
Hello.
Good morning.
How are you, Lisa?
Thanks for inviting me.
Thanks for coming on. As always, you're kind of my go-to for everything about education and tech, so appreciate that. I'm glad you're right down the street, too.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
Well, she's actually right behind me where I live.
Really?
Yeah.
So the guy you see in the bushes at night, that's
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I live right next to the crafts who are their they live right back of them. So I could literally see her house right now.
See, oh, wow. There you go.
Yeah.
That's kind of gives you
that's kind of creeped
out a little bit,
creepy,
doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, maybe Graham, maybe you and I should just leave.
Yeah. Right.
let the Lakeville Mafia do their thing.
south of the river. You could have come over and sat at my dining room table, I guess.
Yeah. You don't want that, because then you have to feed him, and then it's just, you know, he's there, and then he keeps coming back.
Plus, they're in their pajamas still.
Oh, that's bad.
And we came to talk about the iLearn project, so why don't you kind of give us a quick backgrounder on that?
Well, what we decided to do was really build some capacity in our organization in an area that we were woefully behind. You know, we certainly do have some teachers that use technology at high levels, but it's really on their own initiative. And we want it to become a systemic part of the way that we do our business of teaching and learning. So what we did was we identified some new funding primarily from that came out of the last legislative session that only is going to about 12 school districts. So we're fortunate that we are one of them. And we also repurposed some dollars from other district level budgets like textbooks and resources and came up with about $2.1 million to really get this initiative off the ground.
Oh, wow.
One of the initial issues was that we didn't have wireless across our buildings, believe it or not. We have a really strong infrastructure as far as the fiber and the wired, but we had not gone wireless. So about $500,000 of that will have to be dedicated to making sure that all of our buildings are very, very well prepared for mobile technology and mobile learners. So with that, what we did was we made it a competitive grant for our teachers to apply. And as part of that application process, they had to apply as a team of teachers because we feel that people, when they're learning new things, really need to have a team of folks, kind of go-to people. And what they're applying for is basically to get iPads, apps, digital resources, not only in their own hands, but in the hands of their students, their learners. So yesterday was the deadline for the grants, and we had 68 grants. And each one of those represents three or four teachers and lots of students. So we are really excited. Unfortunately, we won't be able to fund all of the grant projects, but our intent is to really try to fund as many as we can across our district so that every building is touched by it, every level of our organization, meaning primary, intermediate, middle school, high school, because we really want to study the implementation. We're going to take a research perspective. We have some key areas that we want to look at. We want to look at student engagement. We want to, of course, look at achievement, and we want to look at time on task. So we're going to be doing some studies to see how learning transforms. It's pretty exciting.
So is this going to be a one-to-one with the tablets and the students?
In some ways, yes, and in some ways, no. It's easier to do that right now with this initiative if it's a fifth grade teacher or any elementary teacher. We can, you know, since they're with the same students all day, actually send them home and do a parent component. But at the secondary level, most of the teachers have asked for classroom sets so that, you know, as the day goes on and they get new classes of students, that every student has an opportunity that they can utilize the technology. So in an ideal world, it would be their own. But we are also gearing up to be much more open to bring your own devices. We've got two pilots going on, one at each high school right now, that are going very, very well. And as long as we have our wireless and we have our permissions and security and guest access, there's no reason why our teachers and our students can't start bringing their own devices at higher levels.
What sorts of applications are you seeing in the applications that have come in for the grants?
Well, we have decided on some district-wide apps that we want to have, but then we really want to use the rest of this year for experimenting and exploring and putting some of that power in the hands of our teachers rather than dictating to them what they want. So we're seeing a wide variety. You know, we have Some teachers at the primary level really focused on literacy, and so they're looking at literacy apps and then, you know, simply just using some of the apps that come on the iPad that kids can read into their tablet and then listen back. And that there's a lot of research out there that it really increases fluency in a very quick way when kids can hear themselves and see themselves reading. So even simple things like that are, you know, a part of it, but it makes a big difference.
Apple's new iBook Author software provides a real opportunity for teachers to create their own interactive books. Do you see teachers in the district adopting that?
I do. I do not see our board ever adopting textbooks again. They already have most recently, I think it was a high school specialized class, and they did not want the hard textbooks. But, you know, we were kind of in a quandary because we didn't have the technology to go completely digital either. So we're in this transition phase. But yes, I do. In fact, it's funny, Jason Molesky, who's really taking the lead on this project until we get our digital learning specialist on board, he already made an iBook with the authoring tool, and it's for the iLearn applicants. So when they get their iPad next week, it'll have a book in their library that walks them through everything from getting an iTunes account to the grant, the program, the research, and he's already authored it. It's just amazing how easy it is.
Can you talk a little bit about the challenges that authors or publishers would have in getting their curriculum approved in the state of Minnesota? In the digital bookstore?
You mean like other textbook companies?
Yeah. I mean, is there an approval process, I guess, where the school board has to get approved for digital like there is for traditional printed books?
I would think so. I mean, you have a textbook adoption process. I would think it would be similar. You're still going to need approval. I suppose, you know, varies from district to district as far as policies. A lot of times there's a dollar figure that you have to, a threshold that you have to reach before you have to go to the board for approval of resources. So with the cost going so, you know, so affordable, it might not reach the threshold of board approval.
Listen, Lisa, tell me a little bit about, this is Phil, a little bit about how you balance the ability or the access for digital devices to access this new program. Obviously, not everybody has the wherewithal or the funding, the money to buy their own device. Obviously, there's going to be devices provided, but how many, will there be people that fall through the cracks that won't necessarily have access to this stuff outside of the classroom?
Oh, I think so, especially now while we're in a transition. I mean, in an ideal world, every learner would have access to the tools at any time. And that's, of course, where we want to go. But we, you know, are going to have to use our available resources to go as far as we can and build support. And whether that's community support through a technology levy in the future to, you know, to make sure that we can continue down this path. Or the other issue is looking at the savings in the organization when you are completely paperless. You know, things like copy machines, which are huge costs in a school district, and paper production. So, you know, I think it's going to be kind of a combination of things as we move forward to make sure that there's equity across the district for all learners.
Well, any thoughts about you know, ending the free ride that all these kids have and putting them to work so they can earn a little money for tablets? I'm kidding.
Well, one of the things that's been really interesting at the leadership level, you know, in the state of Minnesota, you can't ask parents to buy textbooks or things that are required for the curriculum. Yeah. But if you think about it, you know, a tablet over a 3-year leasing program is, even with all the apps and anything else you need, would be well below, let's say, $150 a year. And if that legislation were changed, I think most parents could invest the $150 a year for their students to have, you know, their own device through the school system. But unfortunately, right now, there's laws that stop us. But when you think about, you no longer have to buy a scientific or graphing calculator, you don't have to buy a planner, you know, all the things that parents do buy now, those are all inherent in the technology. So if we didn't have that kind of limit, it would be very easy to have every child have digital tools.
Well, it's my, I just wanted to ask real quickly, it's my understanding that Apple has set forth the policy that the students themselves have to buy these $15 textbooks. Is that your understanding?
No, really, it's not.
Okay.
I've heard that and I've read a little bit about that, but I've also talked with some Apple folks and got very different message that the district can buy the textbooks.
Okay, and allocate them to the devices. Okay.
Yeah, so we're working through that because that's a big question that needs to be answered because in Minnesota, that's not going to work. The kids can buy it right now.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk.
I was going to ask, speaking of Apple, I see that your iLearn partnership is a partnership with Apple, and what is their involvement? Do you work with a local representative, and what's Apple's specific part of this?
Well, they're certainly not giving us anything.
Oh, they aren't. Okay. No,
Apple rarely gives anything.
Yeah. Right. But they do know that we want to be a showcase district. They do know that we are in high speed. You know, we're kind of running from good to great. We want to pass up everyone else as far as really being a forefront leader in this area. And so they're definitely supportive. They're there when we need them. They've come in and done a lot of professional development already with our leadership team, which we haven't been charged for, just in helping us as leaders to move forward. So they have been extremely accessible. They're local people in Minnesota and even some of their folks in Chicago.
Lisa, what kind of things are in place as far as checks and balances? Obviously, yes, it would be great to be a leader in adoption of electronic devices and mobile education in Lakeville and be that showcase. But really, the bottom line is it accomplishing what it needs to accomplish? And is it teaching our kids? Are they learning at a better rate? Are they more engaged? What are the checks and balances in place so that the desire to be hip and cool is not outweighed by or does not outweigh the need for education?
Well, that was one of the key reasons we decided we needed a digital learning leader, and we knew that we needed somebody with really strong pedagogy so that the tools are used for learning and they're tied and aligned to our standards and our outcomes. And so we have a commitment that this is about learning. We have moved that position underneath our teaching and learning, our curriculum department, to really show our staff that this is not a technology initiative, this is a learning initiative. So couple that with the research we're going to do, and I think that we have a pretty good accountability system.
The next question, obviously the dicey one, and the one that you see the most pushback from, in whether you see editorial pieces, letters to the editor. I'm sure that what you've heard from callers and letters, you've managed to put together over $2 million to fund this program. As a parent who went through the process of trying to get a pool built for Century Middle School, who's a parent of a swimmer and wanted to get that back on the table, it seemed like we worked very hard and the board did not necessarily work very hard at trying to find the dollars to make that happen. What do you say to people? Well, like me on occasion, how do you make that priority? It's like, okay, so we want to be the electronic learner, but we're going to have to put those other things that we promised, early on in our building plans, we're going to put those on hold so we can make this happen. How do you kind of defend that against, against the district? With the district?
I think that's an excellent question. School funding is extremely complicated, as you may or may not know, but
ain't that the truth?
For every, so-called pot of money, there's all sorts of rules and regulations of how you can use it. For example, the bulk of this money, 1.1 million of it, is called basic skills money. It's one-time money that we will get. It's not ongoing money, so we certainly wouldn't want to use it for staffing and have to lay people off in a year. So we, for this particular money, it has to be tied to student achievement. And so we can justify utilizing that 1.1 for professional development, for digital resources, for our students because it's going to impact learning. So you can't take that $1.1 million and put it toward a pool project. So a lot of it is about, you know, what, how you can creatively and legally use the money and the resources that are available to you.
Yeah, so what about that pool, Lisa? Can we get that pool on the end?
So I have kind of...
I just abused my privilege. Sorry.
Yeah, yes, you did. This is Steve again. I have a question that may seem like it's a little bit out of left field, but it's only because of some things that I've experienced personally using a tablet versus a computer for all kinds of different tasks, and finding that the iPad itself... It has a cognitive quieting capability that's really, really unusual. And I'm trying to figure out exactly what's going on. And I've started to do some reading, and there are a lot of, especially in education, a lot of different groups that are working on looking at how the iPad or how a tablet and its single app focus in front of you can work with cognitive disabilities, for example, or, you know, does it actually shift the way that people process information? Are you aware of anything that's going on in education research around that?
There's a lot of work being done with autistic children. In fact, I just talked to a Lakeville parent who their child, he said his life is transformed because he has the iPad. And when you hear the stories and how they're able to communicate in new ways and their attention levels are suddenly increasing and better, you know, it's pretty powerful when you're listening to parents. So, you know, anecdotally, I'm hearing some things. I've gone to a couple Apple events where teachers are demonstrating and showing video of their disabled students working with iPads in groups and individually, and it's pretty spectacular to watch. You know, that's one of the reasons why we decided to go completely with the iPad, was because of Apple's commitment to education. You know, some people say, well, why don't you go with Kindles or Nooks or some of the ones that aren't quite as much, but the productivity apps that are on the iPad and the attention to education, right now there's 20,000 educational apps, really made the decision quite clear that, because it's not just, if all you want is an e-reader and all you want is to research the internet, that's one thing. But we want to go much deeper than that. We want to transform the learning environment and make learning accessible anytime.
I'm sure there's probably some taxpayers in the district who may think, especially after the levies have been turned down the last couple of times for upgrades of computers, which I know are desperately needed within the district, that this iPad initiative might be kind of a nice to have thing. Do you see this as sort of the future of education, that this is a vital piece of the curriculum of the district?
Yeah, I'll tell you why. This is not about devices. This is about personalizing learning, and that is where education is going. And it's really a transformational time in education. And to remain in the game, you might say, we have to be able to personalize the learning for every student. And we've talked about that for years. Every student should have an individualized learning plan that is based on their strengths, their passions, their interests. We should be able to assess and diagnose where they are in skill-based learning and be able to help them get to the next level. But we didn't have the tools to do it, and suddenly the tools are available. I mean, there are apps now that can assess where students are at, and maybe you've heard of the School of One out in New York and what they're doing to customize learning in the area of mathematics. I mean, these emerging technologies is about customized learning. And so, you know, that for me is the critical, we're at a critical point. You know, there's virtual schools, charter schools, private, parochial, homeschools. We are in a very competitive environment. And if we don't up our game and improve our organization and our services, we're going to be obsolete. And I truly believe that.
Listen, Lisa, you've worked with Apple to some extent, and we have, you know, two of our four are have financial stakes in Apple. So so while we're all Apple fanboys, we have two that are financially invested. Tell me a little bit about your feeling with Apple. I mean, you hear a lot of from a lot of companies that are really making a statement by donating, by giving back. Very rarely, as you alluded to, very rarely does Apple take the position of giving. I think you could probably say it's almost famous for not giving back, maybe discounting, but not necessarily giving back. What is it that keeps Apple from stepping up?
I have no idea. Maybe you. In that, I really don't know.
Guys, what do you think? What's keeping Apple from stepping up? Because Lisa, she's going to be very diplomatic here because she's very good at that.
And, well, after reading this,
keeps them from stepping up?
Yeah, no, I think it was Steve Jobs actually, personally. After reading the biography, he was an interesting person because he believed in education was critical, and he believed in sort of supporting it, but he didn't believe in a lot of philanthropy. So I think that, you know, the new leadership at Apple, I think, has a different view of that. And I think the Tim Cook Apple will maybe be more generous in a philanthropical sort of way than a Steve Jobs-led Apple. So time will tell. And I think we will see some movement there.
Yeah, I think there will be as well. But I also think that it's people really seriously don't understand the stakes that exist right now in the technology realm. And you know, as everyone's looked at Apple's success, specifically with the iPhone, you know, the perspective is that RIM is downtrending dramatically, and so is Nokia. And, you know, the people are buying iPads instead of laptops, which is, you know, dramatically hurting Microsoft and others. So,
well, Steve, listen, that has absolutely nothing to do with a pile of money that Apple sits on that they don't give back on. I mean, this is one of the world's largest organizations that constantly throws down an incredible amount of cash, and yet you don't hear about what they're doing to give, to share that back with the community that helped build them. I mean, the education community has supported Apple from day one, and Apple has done things to entice them to do so. But it's like time now to step up and share the wealth. That's what I'm saying.
Okay. Well,
I think we might see that.
I hope so. I'd be okay with Lisa. She'd be good with that.
Yeah. No, and I think that we're at a critical time, that this sort of thing is our competitive advantage in the world, as far as competing. And that, you know, as all of the manufacturing has moved offshore, you know, the whole, you know, developing people with ideas who can do startups and run businesses and all this kind of stuff is critical. And developing those skills early on in school, using this kind of technology, I think is vital. So this is really key, and hopefully we'll see this sort of thing roll out across the country.
Yeah, one of the things that's kind of funny, you know, when I sent out a message to parents explaining how we were funding this, why it's critical now to move ahead in this area, I probably received 50 emails within the next few days, very, very positive and supportive, and probably about five that, you know, folks, that what do you need computers in the schools for? And, you know, there's so many reasons, but one of the crazy things is, you know, when you think about the only sector that doesn't have unemployment in our nation, it's the IT sector. But we don't need computers in schools. I mean, there's such a contradiction. It's such a contradiction. Yeah, these are the tools of this generation, and to not have that be a critical part of how they learn and how they experience the world through learning is kind of crazy to me, that you wouldn't do that. You know, you shouldn't power down at the door.
Yeah, if you get those questions in the future, I would just say to them in response, when you were in school, did you have typewriters in school?
Right.
And of course, everyone of our generation and even before would say, of course. And that was a, you know, key skill, and computers and now tablets are the key skill of the current and the future. So
isn't it nice to know that we made the quick brown fox famous?
We used to fight for the electric typewriter too.
Ooh, the electric.
I went through high school in the middle 70s, and that was the big thing. When you hit it big in the typewriting class,
you got the electric.
Typing class, you got the electrics.
All I remember is my grandmother sitting down, and boy, did I learn how to type. Now is the time for all good men to come to the aid of their country.
Boy, have we come a long way, huh?
Yeah, I'll say.
Yeah, I remember Lisa, being excited that my electric typewriter could store 5 research papers. I was pretty excited.
Wow. Oh, wow. 5.
Now that's high tech. I didn't have that. I had to retype my thesis in college about 3 times, and it was painful. It was like a 50-page paper.
Not good.
As far as the mobility and moving these devices from school to school or from school to home, what kind of considerations have been taken, to guard against theft, shrinkage, loss, that sort of damage, that sort of a thing? Is that all part of the program that you've calculated in?
Yeah, we're working through that right now. In fact, we're looking at maybe in some sort of insurance agreement with the parents for the kids that take them home. Also a required mandatory kind of training for the parents as well. Mm-hmm. So basically they'd be signing an agreement, and then if they can afford it, if they're not on free and reduced, coming up with insurance agreement so that if the child drops it and breaks it, that we can replace it for them.
So you've seen your fair share of textbook publishers and textbook salespeople coming through the doors in your career, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. This guy's got to be freaking out.
You would think. I was showing the digital textbook, the one that's free in the iTunes library, to some folks the other day, and they couldn't believe it. I mean, it's so dynamic and interactive. It's just incredible. It's hard to describe.
I can't help but think that kids are going to see this sort of technology, and they're immediately going to, harken back to their read of Harry Potter and the whole concept of these living newspapers and things like that. So I think it's probably going to be very exciting for kids, and I can see where the engagement will really spark them.
Yeah, it's about, when you think about real true learning, it's about curiosity. And when you're curious as a young learner, if you don't have access to finding, to find the information or learn the skill, you kind of lose interest. But one thing, when it's right there, it's a game changer. I see it all the time with my grandchildren. They'll have a question. Well, let's find out. Let's Google that and see what we can find out. They're just so, that curiosity, I just love to see that getting nurtured again.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Well, listen, Lisa, thank you very much for taking some time on a Saturday morning when you usually probably get to sleep in. So we do appreciate you hopping on. I'm looking forward to seeing this implemented in my community. I really am. So thanks very much.
Yes, thanks for your interest.
And then I just want to mention one more thing. Be very, very cautious if Tim Elliott or Phil Wilson come to a school board meeting. Just saying.
Okay. I'll keep that in mind.
All right.
Get the sergeant at arms ready.
Thanks. Thanks again.
We're not really that bad.
It's true. We aren't. Thanks, Lisa, very much. Good luck, and we'll talk soon.
Okay. Sounds good. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
She's the best. I'm so impressed with her. She just,
she's really a breath of fresh air.
She is.
After Dr. Amoroso, who was the superintendent for about, 10 or 11 years here. And he wasn't a bad guy.
$440,000 worth.
Yeah. Right. He wasn't a bad guy, but he really did not adopt any kind of new technology or anything. He sort of was an administrator and status quo kind of guy. And she's really trying to really make some dramatic changes in her first year, which is commendable.
I got to tell you, if you know anything about the Lakeville School Board, that is an undertaking.
I'll bet.
And well, in the process of selecting her, she was the one that clearly stood out. And my wife works in the district, and they had some open meetings. And the first thing she said when she walked up after her presentation was, I want my wife to Dr. Snyder, was, when can you start?
That's great.
Well, I thought her whole focus on personalized learning, customized learning, was fascinating.
Well, and I loved it. What I loved was also talking about really embracing technology, because it's there's a woman here with Eden Prairie Schools, Sally Knabley, who does technology empowerment for staff and trains staff. She's got a team, and she's just constantly pushing back about the fact that she goes, these kids walk in and they've got smartphones and they've got all kinds of different technologies, and we tell them to turn them off and put them in their pocket.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, rather than let's figure out how to leverage them.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
So, well, they're seen as distractions, and right. It was kind of funny because my daughter has a Android phone, and she wanted to record her lectures at college. So I said, I'll put an app on there. And so of course I put the best recording app on there. And she came back and she said, they're not allowing me to use it because it's a phone, because it can be used for texting or what have you. So I have to actually buy her a dedicated recorder, which is okay, God. And not use her existing phone for recording lectures in college. So, I mean, if it's that bad there, it's got to be 10 times worse.
Where is she going to school?
University of Wisconsin at River Falls.
Across the river.
That's amazing.
Across the river and through the woods.
Stream going right through campus.
Yep. you can't expect that, I guess, from Brigham Young, but I don't know. You expect that from UW River Falls.
Yeah, no, I think it's the same. My son goes to American University in Washington, D.C., and it's exactly the same there. It's just a prohibition of any kind of electronic device except a computer. And, you know, we all know that if we had a computer in college, you know, we would figure out ways to distract ourselves with that during a lecture.
And we could do that now during conferences, for God's sake.
Right.
Yes. Yeah.
We distract ourselves all the time.
I was going to say, though, this brings up an interesting point about mobile devices. iPads, especially Wi-Fi-only iPads, can't be used for phone conversations easily. I guess they can be used for texting.
Yeah, texting is the real problem with
this. Yeah. It's. I guess there can still be that distraction with an iPad in a school. Yep. For somebody could go straying off and start texting. So they, in Lakeville or other school districts, and I wanted to talk about Little Falls just briefly, they must have a policy of prohibiting texting while you're using these devices. Right. Well,
and there's clearly ways to block those on the, you know, with
uninstall the technology. Messaging app for one
thing. There you go.
For one thing, yes, uninstall it and lock it up. And there are ways to
simple ways to get around that. Yeah.
And especially if you're not allowing necessarily the student, at least at this juncture, to have it 24/7 where they can actually sit and spend time hacking on it. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out, though.
But, you know, one thing I didn't get, what was this $150 she referred to? Is there a special discount or something for acquiring a...
No, I think she meant over time.
Over time.
Okay. So they're prorating.
If they're leased, yeah.
Right,
leased,
right. Yeah.
Graham's thinking, how can I get me one of them $150?
No. I thought there was... I thought she was talking about some discounted amount that parents could acquire an iPad for, and I thought $150. I mean, what? So what was she alluding to there?
It's a lease program. You know, obviously they're going to work with Apple to lease these devices, and the lease program would be based, you know, spread over an annual, you know,
I see
cost.
Well, that's making it more affordable for more parents, right?
Yeah,
more
but you got to give it back at the end, right?
Yeah.
At least to buy.
What I was wondering, and I don't even know if she has a statistic for this, is what percent, does she have an idea of what percentage of the parents or families in Lakeville already own one?
Well, I'll tell you, if you judge anything by the parents in attendance at last night's swim meet, that's about 90%.
Oh, do they drag them along to?
Oh, sure.
What are they doing? Sharing stats and so forth?
Some of them use them to keep their kids' stats. Others are just using them as video cameras.
Sure. Oh.
Wow. Yeah.
Some are reading books during the 500.
Yep.
That's 5 minutes of dedicated time right there. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, hey, the other thing I alluded to earlier is the Little Falls School District, as you guys probably know, they enabled all their students from grade 5 through 12 to have iPads. I don't know where they got the money to do this, but that was written up last year. I think it started with their with the school year in September. I haven't really followed that, but I know it got a lot of attention and some controversy because the, you know, do you recall reading that where the technology director in the school district was going out to Cupertino and getting wined and dined?
Sure.
I've got a link on this that I can put in the show notes. It's
great.
I don't know how, you know, how the program is doing. I'm sure there's been a lot of things written about how it's doing during the school year, but it's been one of the more impressive adoptions of iPads in a school district in the country, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, have you guys heard about the Nicholas Negroponte thing about the one laptop for child project that's now the one tablet?
Yep.
Project?
Yeah.
And it's a $75 tablet. I'll put a link in the show notes, but do you think that's going to get any traction?
In the third world, absolutely. Just like the Exo, netbook or whatever you want to call it, did and has. I'm not sure about here though. And I'm not sure if that's their focus is to sell them to more developed world kind of scenarios.
Yeah. Okay.
So well, they usually put together programs of, you know, you buy one and we'll, you know, send one overseas. So I think that you'll see a little bit of interest in that, especially I think on the tablet side. I think tablets probably have a little bit more allure than a laptop did.
So, yeah, absolutely. If there was a buy one, get one thing for $150, yeah, that would be very attractive just to have it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, because we got to have more stuff.
Well, you know, and it would make you feel good to support the cause.
Exactly.
Well, I'll tell you,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, Steve. I was just going to say, for those that haven't done so, if you have an iPad or you have access to one, or if you want to stop in the Apple store and just poke around and look at it, go look at iTunes U and download some of the free books if it's yours. And just look at how these are put together, because I look at this stuff and I think, oh my God, would I love to have had any of this when I was in high school or especially college, where, you know, you can click on a video and watch a video explanation of something and you know, everything's at your fingertips, all your assignments, the syllabus, everything's there. Right inside the book.
You think that this is going to kind of branch out and really spark the next wave of publishing? Because I can see this as
absolutely
a perfect platform for magazines. And if you want to save the magazine, make it fully interactive with this kind of software.
Yeah, the only downside that I see with any of this, now we know that there's going to be falling storage costs over time. So right now the biggest storage you can buy for a tablet is 64 gigs as a solid state drive. The only downside is when I download, for example, the Wired magazine for the month, it's 300 to 400 megs and it takes a long time to download. And so I can only imagine if you've got a class of 30 kids and you're downloading all these textbooks to these devices, you're going to have to do it after hours. Otherwise, there's not any bandwidth. So provisioning all these devices, we didn't get into that with her, but you know, there are companies like the local company called Jamf Software that does tools to be able to not only manage Macs, but manage iPhones and iPads and iPod Touches remotely. And as long as they're turned on, they can access all of them and provision the devices and load apps on them and so forth. But these things are huge. They're really fat.
Mm-hmm. Jamf must be getting involved more and more in the education market. I suspect they will be if they aren't yet.
I would think so, yeah.
That's an interesting company that's doing very well, I think.
Yep, and they're a little bit stealth. But for those that don't know, they're down on Washington Avenue in Minneapolis, And I'll put a link to their site in the show notes. But I would also think with Apple's continued acceleration in the enterprise space, that that's got to be pretty great for them too.
Oh yeah. Yep.
So.
I wanted to bring up, just to switch gears a little bit there, one of the links I'll put in the show notes is a New York Times piece on how Apple's wooing educators. And within that piece, it does touch on the fact that Steve Jobs said in a Wired interview that he's given away more technology to schools, in the education market than anyone else on the planet. So in defense of Apple...
He's given them in discounts. Maybe. He considers the discount as I've given more, which is, love you. God love you.
Well, it's something.
It's something. Listen, it is something. And listen, I am a fan of Apple. Don't get me wrong. But I also look at the amount of money and the amount of philanthropy that these people have been involved in, that Apple has been involved in. And I think it's woefully out of kilter.
He's chosen to do things differently with his wife in the whole field of philanthropy. And that's been written about. Too. And, the guy thinks different, he's not another Bill Gates.
He wasn't a Bill Gates. Yeah. That's for sure.
And he talks about that a lot in the biography, right, Tim?
Yeah. No, it's a good read.
Yep. So, that cash hoard though, that approximately $100 billion cash hoard, that's been written about a lot in the last week, the Apple cash hoard.
Yeah, I think they ought to just loan some to me, maybe $1 billion or so.
I think they should see what I can do with it. Why loan it to you? They should give it to you. Dude, you're the first in line anytime there's a new product. They should send you a check, my friend.
I wish.
We'll get the one-time dividend or the recurring dividend, which I don't think will happen, but there may be a one-time dividend of $1.298 a share or something.
Yeah, but remember, $70 billion or so is overseas.
Yes.
So it's not readily accessible without paying a lot of tax on it. So.
Right. Do you know what corporations have to pay on that if they bring it back into the United States? It's like 35% or something outrageous like that. Yeah. So all the big tech companies, Cisco's another one, they're trapped. They've got all this money overseas. And if they bring it to the United States, they get slammed.
Yeah.
So these are global businesses, and it's like, why would they bring it back to the United States? They don't have to. They get penalized for it. This is a major, major issue in corporate America. And people like John Chambers of Cisco have spoken out on it quite eloquently in the Wall Street Journal and other places.
Well, boys, we should wrap it up here and just briefly touch on upcoming events. So what's the startup weekend?
Startup weekend's coming up the 10th through 11th at the U of N Carlson College. So check that out. This is the third one.
It is.
Right.
And it's always an exciting event.
Yeah. It's especially for, web and mobile startups here in the Twin Cities. So that's a great one. And, friend of the show, Dan Grigsby, is one of the judges, as he usually is for these kind of things. So.
Great.
We've had some notable companies that have gone through that program here locally. Conquer, the gaming company, being one that speaks very highly of that startup weekend experience.
Well, we also have WordPress MSP coming up on the 23rd of February. Boy, that's it's nice to see that that's on the calendar already. And
it's a recurring thing. It goes for about 10 months, and then there's a couple of months off. So yeah, that'll be every month, the third Thursday of the month.
Gotcha. And Graham, how to leverage digital media to raise capital.
Hey, I went to the first one. It was awesome. Our friend from last week, Patrick Donahue, is quite the presenter and delivered a very passionate talk covering a lot of what he did in our podcast last week. About how, it's a whole new era in startups, for startups raising money. And it was a very eloquent very well prepared talk, and he filled the room pretty much. That members lounge at COCO is a nice room for an event like that. They had about 30 people in there, and lots of good discussion afterwards. And so I would highly recommend that folks out there catch this second one coming up on, is it February 23rd?
I believe.
Yeah.
Yep, 23rd.
Same location, as I understand it, at COCO.
Well, that's following at the Minneapolis COCO, right?
Yes. Yeah. Grain Exchange.
The following day and the day after is MiniWIC, which is Women in Computing at the University of Minnesota. This looks really interesting at Keller Hall. So check that out. We'll have that in the show notes.
And then Mobile March.
We're set for Mobile March on the 16th and 17th. We hope to be rolling out a fairly solid agenda for you on Monday. So look for that. We are still looking for a call. You know, we still have a call for speakers out there, and we're still getting speaker applications and some good stuff floating out there.
I can come in and talk about my phone.
Sure, why not?
You know what apps I have on my phone? Should I do that?
That would be fascinating.
Yeah, that would be great.
Okay.
Hey, what you should talk about is how that guy came out this last week and suggested that the whole home screen thing is out of control and should be blown up and rebuilt from the ground up. Did you guys see that piece?
No.
I kind of agree with it.
Yeah,
it's
no,
like, it's yeah. way too hard to manage your apps and keep track of them, and you know, and then the whole UI situation has been bastardized by individual app developers, and Apple really needs to rethink that whole home screen thing, is what this guy was saying.
Interesting. Yeah, I do think that it is hard to create folders of apps on the iPad, and I don't know what it's like on Android, because I actually haven't done it where I've consolidated apps by category or something.
Well, I tend to, you know, just put apps that I'm actually going to use on my phone, so I don't have.
Oh,
a lot
that's
of
not
apps,
fun.
So. No, you got to try stuff out. Come on, jeez.
No, this guy was talking more about the icons too, of how they've gone haywire, and you know, Apple had an original intent behind that thing. And if you remember, the home screen when it was created, there was no App Store yet.
Right.
And when they opened it up to, you know, all the developers in the world, that's when the icons started getting real goofy, and the whole idea behind it and the UI vision behind it has just gone crazy. You know?
Well, I think that Amazon is onto something with the Kindle Fire user interface, and it's kind of rough at this point, but the idea of having the stuff available, you know, based upon when you last used it, and in various categories that are automatically, you know, categorized for you on the device. Mm-hmm. I think that's a good idea. And someone like Apple can pick up on that and really change it, because I like that newsstand sort of approach to the user interface.
Yeah. Well, they got to have somebody working big time hard on this, you know, this home screen thing. I'll put the link in the show notes. It was from a blog called MacStories.net.
Yeah, and with the Retina display coming to the iPad 3, I think it's going to, you know, it'll bring it to a head, because it's going to make that current interface look pretty antiquated. Because it really hasn't changed since the iPad came out.
Yeah, right.
That's which, by the way, was two years ago to the day yesterday when the iPad was announced and Mr. Jobs was on stage talking about it. So...
Graham, did you have a little party? Did you?
No, I didn't.
Cake
but I
or anything?
Could have. Actually, I forgot it was the anniversary till this morning, till I saw the story, which I put in the show notes.
You're gonna break Apple's heart.
But it's like 2 years. It's hard to believe and how far it's come and gosh, it's you know, who would have believed that they could sell that many this quickly, you know.
Well, with that fond look back, why don't we go ahead and wrap for the week? And we'll plan on seeing you guys all next week.
Next week, absolutely.
On the Minute 8 Gang podcast.
Hallelujah. Take care, guys.
Enjoy the weekend.
Bye-bye.
turns and she knows what's what. Her clocks are firing and her points are good. What's what? Her clocks are firing and her points are good.